Let's start with our meeting, colleagues, and good morning, TG, and your team. Back to work. Can we go back to what we're supposed to do? I think there are a few apologies. If there are any apologies, since today there's no apology. Morning, Tim. We are right. That must be. We are through with the 60-40. It was explained in such a way that we are very happy. We can move forward now. We are on page 103. Page 103, responsibilities of the National House. Section 38. Clause 1, A, B, C, I, and K. Any other issue that we want to raise there in terms of those clauses? The responsibilities of the National House, of traditional leaders. DG will be to the National House, it will include the co-ensign once a bill is there, because the entire leadership system of our country at the local, at the traditional level. Let's move, Honorable Palisa.
Thank you very much. I just want to find out something from that A. Prepare a strategic plan for a period of 5 years and review it annually. The problem that I'm having is the word strategic. It, to me, it looks like a business plan of some sort. I don't know whether they can elaborate more. How strategic? Because I'm afraid at the end of this week, we will need a strategist. If we're going to use that name, strategic, hence I'm saying it's more like a business plan. I once saw this, it's like a copy and paste of a business plan, sort of. So can they elaborate more why they used that name, strategic? Thank you very much.
Alisa, let me just get it. All the lawyers are here. Parliamentary lawyers are here, state law advisor is here, department lawyers are here, all the senior lawyers are here. Okay. Protege.
Thanks very much, honorable members, good morning. strategic plan, well, the reason why this clause, this section was included, the National House never had any business plan to be able to account for what they do. And in terms of the budget, you know, there is a certain budget that is kind of ring-fenced for the National House, but there was no requirement for strategic plan. It is a strategic plan that departments come up with, which is a five-year plan. And why we are saying it has got to be reviewed annually, it is because like departments, we have got annual performance plan. Towards the end of the year, you review, and then you come up with the next one. But the strategic plan, if it's necessary, you can change it here and there. So it's a strategic plan that departments are doing for accounting purposes. Thanks, Chair.
Five years.
As I understand the chairperson, in terms of the previous discussions that we have had, this is not a proposal for a plan. It's also historical. This is how the House of National Traditional, the House, the National House of Traditional Leaders has tended to manage things. In other words, what I'm saying is it may just be very useful to give a very, very brief historical background.
Stoll, you want to make a point? I thought Honorable Thalisa now is satisfied. You just worry that you don't turn the department or traditional leaders into a business. And then I think he accepted that every year, all department and all state organs, they prepare for strategic plan. Even the committee anyway does that every year, 5 years. A strategic plan within which then you implement your performance plan, your implementable plan, and all those areas. I think one about Thalisa is happy. Thalisa, let's move.
Yes, we can move, sir.
Okay.
Thank you.
Another issue, A to K, these are responsibilities. Yes, what?
Thanks, sir. Okay. I just want to check, when they say we prepare an annual performance plan, the question is how? Can they explain?
The annual performance plan is informed by the strategic 5-year strategic plan. Out of the 5-year strategic plan, then you have the targets. You take the targets of the first year of the 5-year term, and then you break it down in terms of quarters to say quarter one, this is what we're going to do, and then you report on that. Second quarter, you report on that. At the end of the financial year, in our annual report, we'll then incorporate this work of the National House. So, yeah.
Chair, if you go to 104, section 2, subsection 8, that's where mostly this plan is being explained as to how is it going to cooperate with the one for the department. They have explained it there.
Thanks, sir. In E, country maybe adds something like responsibility of the National House should examine and improve draft legislations. Between E and F, should examine and improve draft legislation.
This is page
103.
E is an order code.
I'm proposing, Shane.
A new clause.
Yes.
Examine and improve.
Che?
Yes.
That's dealt with in the next clause.
The suggestion by Honorable Travis, the traditional house, has they got powers to draft legislation? So I don't think it will fit here.
I thought that we agreed, General, that the traditional house of traditional leaders, all of them, they will be consulted. They become a forum, national forum, for them to be consulted. They can also make some proposal to the drafting of the legislation that is relating to what they are doing as traditional leaders. Even a bill is referred to them, surely we'll expect them to make some proposal. But they can't draft the bill because they're not mandated to do so. But they can appear before this committee and say, in this and this, we think this one is going to affect us. As a result of that, you want to make this proposal. Then a proposal can be considered by the committee, whether we reject it or not reject it. I think Khalisa is just saying that tighten it up a little bit. And then I think with the point we'll see. But it's covered as we move on. We'll come back to it if it's not covered completely. But in the following clauses, they are covered, what exactly they should do and what does it mean. Okay. Can we move on? 3A, B, yellow one, new, rework, refine, red one, discarded. Honorable Dube, are you fine? 3A and B, no issue there. And the new one that is inserted, we accept it. Can we move to section 39? 1A. Yes. Honorable Benham.
Chair, I believe this clause is particularly or is overly broad in that any parliamentary bill which may affect traditional or Khoisan communities. So if we pass a law about, I don't know, smoking, it has an effect on traditional and Khoisan communities. It affects them. Maybe not directly, but they are affected by the bill, just as any other South African citizen is. And I believe that the way the clause is worded is overly broad, because you'd basically be referring every single bill of parliament to the National House of Traditional Leaders. So that first part, any parliamentary bill which may affect traditional leaders, can I suggest that we reword that something along the lines of which directly affects traditional and Khoisan communities on any matter identified in section 212 of the Constitution? Then you could leave the rest of it must before it is passed. But if you leave it as it is, it basically is suggesting that every single bill would have to go to the National House for essentially concurrence and input. That's the first part, Chair. The second part is all pertaining to any matter referred to in Section 1542 of the Constitution. Now, Section 1542 refers specifically to municipalities in local government, in cooperative governance. And it talks about draft national or provincial legislation that affects the status, institutions, powers, or functions of local government. And it specifically says that any municipality, organized local government, or other interested persons are afforded an opportunity to make representation. But essentially what you're saying here is that this legislation must be sent to the National House of Traditional Leaders for their input. Now, if they want to make an input, they have the right to do so in terms of Section 1542 already. By referring it to them specifically, you are imposing an additional legislative process. You are saying that any bill that affects a municipality must go through the National House of Traditional Leaders, where, as I said before, they have the right to comment should they wish to, but by imposing that, we are actually delaying our legislative process and we're imposing a condition that is not envisaged in the Constitution.
legal mind, if first, we agree that from time to time they will participate. They will come, make presentation. In fact, like all South Africans, they have a right to make a representation for whatever bill that we are preparing. But we must not make it obligatory for every bill of parliament to go to. They are not lawmakers. But they should be consulted also to ensure that anything that I thought we agree that something that is really have a very direct impact on the traditional leadership system. Not every bill we have to take it to them. I think it would be very difficult. But of course, they will also have to deal with the demarcation, surely have a direct impact on them. But the other bill that they will not need them at all. I'm not sure which bill would be that anyway. That doesn't need a section of the society, generally speaking. It would be very rare to have bills that they don't need anyone to participate. But I think Melham make a point that let us not make it obligatory. This thing is to facilitate, if they have a view around tobacco, because they're doing something with tobacco, sure, they can make a presentation like all other organizations in society. But I think the point I say is that let us not do it as if it's compulsory to do so. There will be areas that are relevant to them, that have an impact on them. As traditional leaders, surely you have to consult them and have a discussion around that. As Todd.
Chairperson, thank you. When reading this clause, I don't see any problem really in referring a bill as indicated to the National House, because the clause does not say Parliament shall not pass that bill with or without the inputs of the National House. It only says it will be referred to the National House. Now, as to whether the National House makes inputs or does not make inputs, that does not hamper the processing of the bill. So, any bill, basically, that has something, let's take, for instance, the Municipal Structures Act. It has a Section 81 which directly affects traditional leaders, which they have to make comments on it. And I don't see any harm in referring such a bill, then it's up to the National House to make comments or not to make comments. But in this clause, it doesn't say that Parliament shall not pass that bill if there is no comments from the National House. So, Chair, referring the bill is just to say, here is a bill, make comments if you want to, if you don't want to, it's fine.
Pumela.
Thank you, Chairperson. Greetings to all the members and everyone in the House. Chairperson, just two things I want to bring clarity on. The first one is that the existing provision of the current Act, which was Section 18, was also making it mandatory to say that bills that pertain to customs or customary law must go to the National House. It was a must. And when we did our presentation on the briefing of the bill, we did indicate that perhaps the issue is with the May, where it says any parliamentary bill which may affect traditional or Khoisan communities, and it goes on. That one is definitely a problem, as I said, and it will be only a problem for tagging purposes, because it will be difficult to identify and ascertain clearly how do we say this pertains and this may or may not affect the customs or the customary law. But on the second part, Chairperson, where the department has added reference to Section 154(2) of the Constitution, perhaps if members are still not clear, elaboration can take place there to bring more clarity as to why now we are adding that part or what sought to be achieved. But my understanding, as I look at it now, considering that in terms of Chapter 12 of the Constitution, the traditional leaders are recognized and placed at local government, and that is what Chapter 12, in terms of Section 212(1), it says traditional leadership, national legislation may provide for role for traditional leadership as an institution at local level on matters affecting local communities. So considering that 154 speaks to functions and objectives that the local government should achieve, I would understand or appreciate that then the bringing into this provision of Section 154 may perhaps be stemming from that provision that in any way the Constitution is recognizing traditional leaders or it mandates national legislation to give them a role, but within local government as and on matters that affect local communities. But then as we indicate, the relation and clarity must still be sought there to say, are these matters that relate to local, are these matters that should be dealt with by traditional leaders and to what extent? Because it needs to be clear for all those that will be implementing this provision. Thank you, Chair.
Chairperson, just to add on the clarity, currently, as you were saying, the bill, the act as it stands, it allows for the referral of bills pertaining to customs to the National House. But now I want to read what is before us, because that one is no longer an issue. The issue in front of us that the member is seeking clarity is two issues. The first issue, as she was saying, is the bill which affects traditional and Khoisan communities. And the bill which pertains to customs, customary law, that bill is a requirement. It must go to Parliament. It must be referred to the National House for their comments because it deals with matters which pertains, which affects them directly. The second part, which is brought now in this bill, is the matter pertaining to matters referred to in Section 1542. As the Honourable Member was reading to us, 1542. And you go to 1542, what are those matters that should be referred now, should now be referred to the National House? Is the matters that affect the status, institutions, powers, or functions of local government. Currently in the Constitution, Section 1542, those matters must be published for public comment. And everyone who's affected must make input. That's what is happening currently in terms of the Constitution. What this bill does now, we're taking it further. We're reinforcing what is already stated in the Constitution. That's what it seeks to do. It says now, even those matters that pertain to those which are listed in 1542 must also, may, it's not a must here, if you understand the difference. These matters may, and it's a discretion, may be referred to the National House for the comments. But the first one that pertains to traditions, customs, and so on, that one is a requirement. They must be referred. So I just want to broaden that distinction between the two. As far as the 1542 matters, that one is a discretion. They may be referred. There's no obligation. As far as matters pertaining to customs and traditions, as is the case now, that one is a requirement. They must be referred. And mostly, they are referred mainly for comments, nothing else. Thanks, Chairperson.
Chair, with all due respect to our law advisers, first of all, I understand very well the difference between may and must. I understand it very, very well. I draft legislation. That's my job. I'm a legislator. So I understand what may means and I understand what must means. The first part says any parliamentary bill which may affect, but then it goes on, must be referred. And the second part says all pertaining to any matter must be referred. All pertaining to customary law must be referred. There's no may be referred. It says it must be referred. That's what it says. Now, if it must be referred, then it gives you a 60-day limit for the National House of Traditional Leaders to provide comment. And if that 60-day limit, if this House goes ahead and passes that bill in the meantime, it's unparliamentary. It's unconstitutional. Because we've got to give them that 60 days in which to comment. And that's imposing a legislative requirement on all bills of Parliament. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, the State Law Advisor says that Section 212 imposes a mandate on referring matters affecting. No, it doesn't. It says in section 212 that national legislation may provide a role. It doesn't say it must provide a role. It says it may provide a role. That's what section 212 actually says. So that's not a mandate. That's not obligatory. That's optional. Now what I'm saying here is I have no problem with any parliamentary bill pertaining to customary law or customs of traditional and Khoisan communities. I have no problem with that must be referred. I have absolutely no problem with that whatsoever. What I have a problem with is twofold. What happens when an amendment to the MFMA, the Municipal Finance Management Act, must be referred to the National House of Traditional Leaders? There is no governance role for traditional leaders envisaged in the Constitution. They have no role as part of the governance structure. They have a role to represent local communities, to provide input, to facilitate discussions, etc., etc. All those things that the DG spoke about a couple of weeks ago when he said there were five areas that traditional leaders should focus on that come out of the white paper on traditional leadership. Nowhere in those five areas do they talk about governance. So as soon as you start imposing that bills must go through the National House of Traditional Leaders, you are imposing a governance role on them. Secondly, by saying that at a local level they have a governance role, even the Section 81 of the Systems Act makes no provision for governance. It says they are there to provide input, to facilitate discussion, to represent their communities, and to take that back to their communities. It makes no decision-making role. Now here, we are saying that every single bill that may affect either local government or may affect the broader community must be referred. And I'm saying that's wrong. I'm arguing that anything that pertains to customary law absolutely must be referred. Anything that pertains to customs must be referred. But anything else, they have the option already in terms of the Constitution to give their input as stakeholders, just like any other stakeholder. They are called to public hearings. We publicize, why must a bill be referred to them? Why shouldn't we refer a bill, for argument's sake, to the National Forum of Religious Leaders? There's nothing that says that we shouldn't refer something to religious leaders. But what you're saying here is one group of stakeholders must be consulted on this. And I'm saying that is wrong because it's imposing a legislative process that is not envisaged in the Constitution.
Okay. Let's see other views. I just thought that we may also use hammers to kill a fly, and then try to stop a hurricane and use a hammer. It won't work. I think let us engage in a manner that assists all of us to understand what are the issues. The issue that is raised is that we can't force government, particular parliament, to refer every bill there. There will be bills that general, that are pertaining to the role and function of traditional leaders. We must consult them. They are not lawmakers. But all the other bills that really, they can also comment like any other citizen of our country. No one is obliged to give them a hearing if they don't want to come forward. I think those who are drafting, they have explained it in terms of how they see it. But I think the point that I'm very worried about is when it's obligatory for anything that we deal with, and they can cause unnecessary problem. Maybe a language issue, we can assist on that. But it shouldn't be a big problem. And we must allow staff also to be free in our meeting. To add our views, to guide where they can. We shouldn't hammer them down. Yes, sir. You wanted to make a point?
What I want to say, the clause that the Honorable Member is reading is from the old version. That clause has been amended, and what I was reading to say the first one is an obligation, and the second one is a discretion. I'm reading it from the amendment. The one that is reading is from the old version of the bill before it was amended. I just want to clarify that point.
Chairperson, that is also what I wish to clarify. When we started the process, we did indicate that the committee requested that we give them a version that can incorporate changes. And that was the word perfect that came directly from the state law advisors when they certified the bill. But as the process is moving, there are amendments that have already been brought before the members, some of which the department already spoke to. Hence, when we do this process, when we are following this process, we need to look at both the A list, even though it's not an official A list, but it is the proposals that are guiding the discussions as well as what we indicate when we eventually bring clarity on board. And what my colleague was explaining here is exactly that, and I think it is a fault on our side perhaps that we need to take and accept in this instance to say we were speaking on something when members are on something else. But basically, we need to be using both documents, the one that is the proposed A list, because some of the changes that have already been spoken to and that were discussed previously, even though we're still going to add what the members have indicated and deliberated on, but that A list is a good guidance and a good direction as to where we are going. And basically, from the new proposal, all the concerns that the member has raised, they are actually covered there, because they must, as an obligation, only relate to the bills that pertain to customary law or customs. And that is clear in the new drafting. We've actually captured exactly as he has indicated. Thank you, Chair.
Look at it. It seems Honorable Melham has been already clarified. And then as we say that every time we have discussion with them, they go back to the department, they change some of the issues. But the point that we said also that after we have done it clause by clause, we'll have then a cleaning up campaign where we look at it again, that everything that we have said, I think we'll put a mark on this issue at Pumalele. And then just to ensure that when we come back to clean now every amended, the wording and everything, will take us one day. And then we finalize it completely on that. And we sign it off in terms of the committee work. And Melham, in fact, then we are repeating what already we have agreed on, because that's what we agreed, that it can't be obligatory for every bill of parliament taken to House of Traditional Leaders. If they pick it up like any other South African citizen, they got the right to come and make presentation. Not only to this committee anyway, in other committees where they can. Maybe the bill is about economy, local economic development. They got interest in that, surely. They should go to that committee that is responsible for that and make their presentation. Okay. Okay, colleagues, that's good. Let's go to B, National House Mass, within 60 days. I think what the days issue we have agreed, eh? Yes, well.
Chair, the 90 days issue referred to specific circumstances relating to the election and appointment of people to councils and the like. I think that it's not a blanket 90 days everywhere. It was just in those cases that we agreed that everything needed to align with relation to the appointment and election of people to councils. Mm.
No, that one is a concluded issue. I thought the 60 days and 2 months for them to have time to make presentation, we have agreed on that one. Can we move to two provincial legislatures and municipal council? Any issue there? Giving guidance there? Can we move to section 40? We have there a question of kings and queens, traditional council, how they will be elected, and then DG will withdraw if they don't qualify. The branches in Alexandra, everywhere, and somewhere in Shushua. We have dealt with that one. Can we go for A, B, C, and D? Any issue there that we think is problematic need more elaboration? When I would try, at least I don't want to apply to be a king.
No, you can apply.
And then, but must be approved.
I've got a proposal, Chair, to add the protecting rights of the coins.
That is clause section 40.
Yes.
A, B, C. You are adding protecting right of coins.
Yes.
I think it's covered somewhere. Okay.
Chair, my concern is going back to the discussion we had the other day that there are no recognized Khoi and San kings, and this the National House may meet with recognized kings and queens to discuss. So why would they meet with kings and queens from traditional leadership to discuss protecting the rights of Khoi and San? It's just a disconnect as far as I'm concerned, Chair.
No, it's making a point that we mustn't ignore that Khoi and San are there historically and otherwise, but I think just raise the point really, not necessarily to put it on a bill. We would find a space to include it somewhere. Can we move to 2? That is 40, relationship between National House and Provincial Houses. Is administrative in nature. Stop.
Chairperson, I was thinking aloud and
you are not allowed to think aloud.
No, I'm just having a dream, Chair.
The daydreaming is a problem, eh?
No, Chair, I was just caucusing with my colleagues here trying to establish where are we featuring the house of traditional leaders engaging the principal traditional leaders, because principal traditional leaders are not allowed to be members of the National House, no provincial houses. It would seem to me there is a gap that we are creating somewhere. I don't know how best can we close that gap so that all sections of traditional leadership are covered. And that is the dream aloud, or thinking aloud that I'm having.
Did she?
Yes, thanks, Chairperson. I think it's indeed a gap, and wouldn't we accommodate it on the heading there on the 40?
40.
Yeah, I would just say relationship between National House, kings, principal, queens, and then because it's the elements on A to D.
Yeah, covering everyone.
Covering everyone.
Then it's a relationship between National House, traditional, what is it, principals, and kings and queens. Just to follow protocol that you said that we must follow. And then they work, then A to D addresses how relationship will work in all these structures. Stoll, we are closing the gap. Don't forget that as they pass on, paramount chiefs. We don't have paramount chiefs yet. I thought you were proposing one. No. This senior, the principal one will remain intact. They must be consulted one way or another. But there are not many. Because it's only they develop in where there were disputes about kingship. And then when the king pass on, then the next one becomes the principal. Therefore, there are not going to be so many. Consultation should be sometimes at the provincial level. But also the National House can consult them if there are issues that needs them at the national level. I think putting them there, clause section 40, could serve the purpose. Bob.
Better clarity on this, the issue of the principal traditionally, I mean the queen or king dying and having the principal traditional leader in his place. That's what we are saying, isn't it? Now,
disputed one. Don't forget that the agreement is that if there are two Mitsipes who claim to be kings,
okay,
they went through a process and they say that this is a rightful house. Then another house, then as a king dies, they become principal traditional leaders. They're no longer kingdom because they've been withdrawn their kingship there.
Okay. No, I and I remember.
Yeah. They will disappear as they go older. Mm. The many of them in Matsipes anyway.
No.
Maybe also you're part of them. Okay. No pretenders. No pretenders. Okay. No, I think we agree that we are going to capture it there. 40 principal leaders. There are not many. I think in South Africa's toilet about 5. About 7. Or they are going to have their own principal team somewhere. What interest are they going to serve anyway? Except that we are trying to accommodate them because they try to hijack a kingdom. And then we are giving them some status that they don't even deserve anyway. Because if he was told he wanted to be a king, he went through all the process, decision is made, failing, we are not supposed to be. Surely, we should disappear. But what we are doing is just to buy them, I think it's carrot and stick approach. And then we are persuading, appeasement in fact, appeasing them that they will die is a very problematic way of doing things. We are a principal or no principal, it can't be in between. But it's fine. I think we put some relationship there that will deal with them in that way. Okay. Can we put to 41? Provincial houses there. 9 of them. I think there will be 9 now.
Yeah.
Honorable Papel.
Yeah,
after the bill has been passed and made law. There will be 9 traditionally. Every province, except in Gauteng, there are only 2.
I don't know whether there are questions
or not. They won't have a branch. There are 2 branches. There will be in Duna, Zakone, Soweto, and other areas. Nothing more than that. Yeah, there will be in Duna only. 41, colleagues, section 41, 1A2C. Those clauses. Provincial, that is the relationship between the two. Delegating some issues there for provincial houses to deal with them. Any issue there, A to C? Let's go to clause 2. Clause 2, page 106. Honorable Mtembu, you are fine? I'm worried now. It seems we're in standard form. There are no flats in standard. They are still coming. Still coming. And the DG, I hope your disaster management team is ready. It's very hot. I think even this heat is going to cause disaster. It's very hot. Can we move to clause 3? Bob.
1.
That is section 41, page 106.
Clause 2.
Where the National House?
Yeah, where the National House wishes to interact with a local house for a traditional request and council. Such interaction must be done in consultation with the relevant provincial house.
Yeah. That don't just see.
Okay.
Inkosi is still up with Kotsako. I think it's China who China to Yahoo. Finally, you should allow. I fully mandate. Yeah, consultant. The protocol. Otherwise, we end up with signing local deals and my companies. Honorable Masipi, all right?
When you say you're bringing the question of signing deals,
not a consultation. And then the National House goes to Limpopo to consult a traditional provincial house. When you go to local, also you consult the local one, just to ensure that at least there's information, there's acknowledgement, all those issues. You're not seeking a permission in general, but to ensure that everyone is informed. That's what we are doing also on Abu Matsipe. When you go to KZN, you touch your structure there. I'm here. When you go to Durban, you touch your structure there in Durban. I'm here. Or Etegwin or Johannesburg. That really try to ensure that also they're covered accordingly. Can you? Well, even if you go to swim as in the Queen course, Queen, finally shooting, it's all swim all up at Depe. Squaz who to call, and that's when the loot of a squaz who to call. In as in course, he fell at Depe, and this is to air your funan at Depe. I as one more to this at Depe. And then he land a lapit in corner. I got cool with my commoners as stall. Commoners must always know that in course he called. As a bambi in course in goons. because I have the let us move on. Let's go to 3. Let's go to 4. The Secretary of National House. Can we move on? Support to National House, Clause 42, 1, Section 42, 1. A may include the provision of infrastructure, human skills, administrative. DG, as we understood it, it is your team that give them support. Secretariat support, infrastructure, maybe offices somewhere, renting and other issues there. And then Honorable Papel has to take a decision at a certain point where their house of meeting national and other issues that they've raised. Any issue there? Can we move to B? Financial support again from the... Yes, ma'am.
Chair, I have no problem with this except to add in after must include financial support, something along the lines of subject to the budgetary limitations of the department. Because otherwise, the National House comes and says, I want 100 million rand, and the department says, whoa, I've only got 10 million rand, and this is imposing that. subclause 2 doesn't actually say that it's subject to the budgetary limitations of the... It says the National House must submit an estimate of budget, but it doesn't say that it's subject to the limitations. I'm saying that you can have money subject to how much money we have available to give to you.
Honorable Malham, you're defending the department. You don't want DG really to explain to them every time. Because surely when they present a budget, it will be a big budget. There's a very important structure. And then sometimes you can't find them in everything that they want. You'll find them wherever possible in terms of the allocation of resources to a department. I think they'll need more money, truly speaking. Like all people who make budget, they need more money. And then treasurer tell them, now there's only 5.50 rand. There's no 100 rand here. I think Melham is just tightening it up for them to move on that. There's no harm in doing that anyway, subject to the available resources. Honorable Mthethwa.
But is there any need of this clause, Chair? Because any budget, it needs to go through reviewal, approval. It's a matter of resources. Do we have to just put it down here, subject? If they want 1 billion rand and the 300,000, they must work within the 300,000 of the budget cuts out.
But
why do we have to really emphasize that point?
Dealing with about two important youngers.
They are important, Chair, but they cannot just shoot the budget to any unlimited.
Yeah,
we are also working on the same basis here, but nobody told us there's no clause that guides it. But we are told there's no funds, we must work within the limit. And it just goes like that.
Honorable Deputy Minister.
The current practice tells us otherwise. When Honorable Mel was debating during the technical in the House and saying, why 14 years after the traditional councils were not instituted, just as an example, in Limpopo and in Mpumalanga, they told us that they don't have money to do that. So now we want to circumvent that issue that they must be given support, full stop. We don't say how much, then that gets determined by whatever the provinces can do. You leave it out, then those who are in power to make decisions, they say it's not even in the law, I can live without giving them money. So I think coming from the 23 years of the democracy, certain emphasis are important so that the day Honorable Mthethwa is a minister, he doesn't do the same.
Not a bad idea. But I think Honorable Mthethwa says we shouldn't write subject to availability of resources.
But there must be
support. I think he accepted that. I think to him was about the qualification that was raised by Honorable Melham. But again, there's no harm really to say that because it covers you also. As a DG to say that, but we don't have these resources. Don't forget that they are not just commoners, but also they are a little bit having historical issues. Then we have to cover yourself and protect you. It doesn't cause harm what really is discussed. I think we can, lawyers, does it cause harm, Pumelele? Doesn't cause harm. Okay. When I'm a lawyer, might have caused harm. That's a court of a civil. Can we move on to 43, section 43, page 107, annual report of National House. They must report. It's very important that also they report about their program, their performance plan, and then it's a good idea. Let us, section 43.1. I think we accept this. Because we'll give them reports, we are going to give them resources, at least they must report. Can we then go to section 43, clause 2, the information to be contained in the report? This is a guidance, really. A to J. The main report should cover all this sub-item issue. But also, the traditional council also, they are reporting BESTA. They also report. Also, they report to communities. And the report at least would be a certain element. Bob.
If you are saying traditional leaders also do report to their community, is that what you are saying, Chair? You say they are reporting to their communities?
No. Well, what I'm saying that they are expected, traditional council must report. The provincial one, houses must report. National houses, including COI and SEN, must report. Then the report would be addressing all this composition of how the report should be.
Yes, sir. Let's make it a must, because they don't report.
They don't report?
Yeah. In this bill, let's make it a must.
Must report?
Yeah. It is a must. They don't report at all.
Okay. But because we're in Duna now, we are going to report now. I thought you were available for election.
The day he retires.
Yeah. Okay. It doesn't want to leave Parliament and Bain Duna. Okay. The A, B, C, D, E, F, J. Any issue there, colleagues, that you think must be elaborated on? Can we move on? 3A, 108, the minister may, B, any House of Parliament, meaning NCOP and National Assembly. Privileges and immunities, 44, section 44.1. Can we move to 2? 109, clause 2A, clause 2B, Roman figure 1. Yes, Honorable Madam.
Chair, one of the reasons why we have privileges in the legislatures is to be able to expose wrongdoing, corruption, maladministration, etc. In fact, I would argue that's probably the primary reason why we have privilege in a legislative body. This is not a legislative body. So why are we granting traditional leaders the same privileges as a member of parliament or a member of the provincial legislature? Why are we granting them immunity from civil or criminal prosecution, arrest, imprisonment, or damages? I can see no legitimate basis for that, except to say, well, you know what? You can say what you like. Nobody's going to hold you responsible for what you say.
Honorable Masono. Honorable Kubisa will follow.
Just on that, maybe it's just given the fact that we have had some practices that are not quite in keeping with democracy and related conduct in many of these institutions. I guess this is to provide space for people to engage and discuss matters in a way that takes our society forward.
Okay.
There are indeed, very negative practices in some of the tribal ethnic environments. Like abuse, for instance, of the fact that this thing of saying, if I've spoken, you know, who are you to speak? I have a last word on this matter. Not that it's that widespread, but it's something that I think is anticipated and assumed.
Colleagues, the point that is raised, that there are no lawmakers. They don't make law of a kind, but they participate in lawmaking processes, like all other structures that in communities and society. But they will have a national house, surely, when they speak there in the debate, one way or another must be protected. If sometimes they raise a very, very serious issues, because also the king and the queens, also they can expose corruption where it exists. I guess that is the main purpose, did you?
No, definitely. I also agree that... if someone has said something and so on, and another person feels aggrieved, then, you know, they must be protected in a particular way, especially if one understands the context of the culture and the respect accorded to that and so on. Yeah.
Honorable Kubisa.
Thank you very much, Jefferson. I wanted to concur with Honorable Masson that when the two there is a need for a candidate there to somehow protect So then the second thing will be, and also to allow those debates to be more robust, because once you don't have that immunity, a pair of worms might be open. Somebody out there who's not within the structure might throw stones, and you'll find that at the end of the day, the house might be dysfunctional. So there must be a way of cabinet from cabinet to ensure that those debates are robust and they're able to come up with policies. Understandable, they are not members of parliament, but they do participate in the legislative making.
But also the national house and provincial houses, a lot of other areas that they can be. You want to protect them when they raise issues that are within the older broad parameters of a freedom of speech. I don't think really kills us to allow it in there. We take the point that Honorable Melham was wanting clarity on it. But it seems general. There's no harm also in protecting them. Okay. Can we move to B? One and the same. Roman figure 1 and 2. One and the same issue. Let's move to clause 45. Deal with the remuneration. DA objection is noted. Melham, what was the reason anyway for objecting?
I don't believe that there are sufficient grounds for the privilege that's being granted here to traditional leaders in the National House of Traditional Leaders.
But the House is evolving. The House is evolving. Thank you very much. We'll take the point that you are raising. Let us move on. Let's move on. Deal with the remunerations. Any issue there? No issue there. It really is not decided by them. Public Office Bearers Act. Can we move to rules, orders, and committees of the House? Section 46. 1, A, B, C, and F. Any issue there that we think doesn't supposed to be there, have to be elaborated on, explained? Honorable Masir?
I'm just asking as to, while we're on this clause, the issue of orders in proceedings. Why is this requirement absent in the local municipalities? There are no rules and orders. Why is it that this is not enforced at that level?
Honorable Kubisa?
I think in the municipality there are rules.
But rules.
My experience, when we come to council, convene a meeting whereby the standards that will be governed, you're working into the administration.
Yes, I agree with you, Prof. I agree with you, there may be rules, but the problem is they are not being implemented in some municipalities. They are not being implemented. I once said in our committee that some speakers, they go to the extent of inviting vigilante groups in council, in the public gallery, to say, you dare speak, here they are. I'm talking from experience.
They intimidate members.
Precisely.
No. So
what I'm saying is, let's try and have...
But the rules are there.
They are there, but okay. Who must enforce them if they are not enforced at that level?
Okay. Well, the speakers there, they should enforce the rules. We must monitor the implementation. I can see the leadership is assisting you. There's no harm in that. Absolutely no harm in that. Okay, let us move on, colleagues. Thank you very much. Honorable Masondo, Honorable Mtetwa, you are two. Let us move on. Colleagues on 2110. Dissolution of a National House, Section 47, 1A and B. Honorable Professor Kubisa, you are fine with that? No issue? That's why we are amending the rule. Doesn't mean that it was like this for 20 years ago. May not be relevant now. Get rid of it. It worked better. Melham?
Chair, just a clarity with regard to 47.1b. That's a higher requirement than is required to dissolve Parliament. Parliament dissolves on a 50% plus one vote of the members. This is saying a two-thirds majority vote. Is there a reason why the requirement is so high?
But we had also discussed this matter on the traditional councils. I think we arrived at a decision that it should be 50 plus one. Because we had a long discussion about how we dissolve them. It was very high. They don't amend the constitution of the country. We need two-thirds majority to amend the constitution of the country and other areas. This one, really, they are participating in the overall governance system in our country. Let us not kill them. Honorable, they can dissolve you with 51 member there. Okay, let's go to 2. Notwithstanding the dissolution, A and B. Can we move on? Bob.
I'm not sure. I just wanted to know how legal will be the proceedings that the House will have with the minister after the dissolution. Because after the dissolution, the minister may summon them for a meeting before the first meeting of the next House.
I thought that the dissolved structure is dissolved.
Chairperson, you see, the National House is composed of members who are coming from provinces. And should any provincial house not constitute on time, that will render a National House ineffective. Therefore, this is a transitional period that the term of office has ended on this day. However, should there be any matter that is urgent, that requires an attention, the minister can summon the House, which will still be legal to do that. And the House will still be legal to operate for that specific matters that the minister would want the House to deal with at that point in time. So this is that particular transitional arrangement between the new house and the old house, even though the term of office has expired. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Now, it's very complex to all of us. Dissolution and expiry of a date are two separate issues. I thought that if they meet and 50 plus 1, they dissolve the National House, for whatever reasons, the minister can't call them back because that is all. If a dissolution is based on that some or two other provinces have never forwarded their members to sit in the National House, a separate issue completely. I thought the dissolution, as it here on page 110, it talks about when they meet, they take a decision to dissolve themselves for whatever reason that they want to do so. It's one thing that Gauteng has not elected a delegate to to come and represent Gauteng in the National House of Traditional Leaders, then it's a separate issue there, that maybe they're not forming a quorum for whatever reason. Did you?
Thanks, Chairperson. Just to give you an example, I think this clause was in the it's in the Framework Act at national level. We have a crisis now with provinces that did not align with the Framework Act, and the terms expired at different times, and when they are dissolved, there must be interim arrangement. You know, for example, let's give you a practical example in Limpopo. The term expired during initiation time. And if it expires during initiation time, the provincial house in each province plays a central role. If it is dissolved and members cannot be called back in the interim until a new structure comes in, then you have a crisis. So this is intended for that purpose, so that if there is an issue, that something that happens, the minister at national level is able to call them back so that the business can continue to be executed. One day, lastly, I came to appear before the portfolio committee, and I think before the current National House term expired, the previous one, and there was only the Secretary of the House and Secretaries of the Houses in other provinces, and for a period of 6 months. And, you know, we were supposed to come and account, so I was accounting on operational things. So it was a very difficult thing that year, because I was told that, why are you operating? Then I said the house is not operating, and so on. So we're balancing that kind of
Honourable Miller.
Chair, just one question, and maybe I missed it. What happens in the instance that a National House is dissolved? Is there a time period within which it must be reestablished? Is there a process for which it must be reestablished? Do we go through the whole process from the beginning again? Because it's not. Again, I might have missed it, but I don't see anything here that says when it's dissolved, we must. I see that there's an election and appointment for the term of office, but I don't see what happens when it dissolves.
Austin.
Thank you, Chair. What currently, I'll speak about currently, what happens is the minister is required to write to provinces 30 days before the expiry of the term of the National House, for provinces to start to reconstitute. Remember, all these structures build up to the National House. So 30 days prior to the end, to the expiry of the term of the National House, the minister write to the premiers to inform the premiers that the National House term will be expiring on such a date, and therefore we are requested or required in terms of this section to reconstitute your provincial and local houses. So within that period, then provinces must reconstitute so that the National House has members. That is what is currently happening. But what the Honourable Member is talking about, the time frame, it's only a time frame prior to the expiry of the term of office. There isn't any time frame that the National House must be reconstituted if the time frame has expired today. How many, something like that.
I understand the process that we go through on the expiry of term of office. That's one story. But what happens where the National House dissolves itself? In other words, what process gets followed? It's not the expiry of the term of office. The term of office only ends in 2022. But in 2019, the National House decides to dissolve itself. Now what happens? You sit without a National House because it says until the first meeting of the next National House. But that's only going to be in 2022. I'm saying there should be some kind of provision for the re-establishment, that you go back to the provincial houses and ask them to re-elect their members of the National House.
I thought that's what you were talking about.
And Chair, just before we go down the route of there being vacancies in the National House, it's not a vacancy because the House is dissolved. So you'd have to re-elect all of the members of the National House at all of the provinces. What I'm suggesting is that there needs to be a clause inserted here after clause 2 that says when the National House is dissolved, the minister must request the provincial houses within, must submit within 30 days a request to the provincial houses, who then have 30 days to elect their members or whatever, so that a new National House can be constituted. And the expiry of the term of office shall be as per the expiry of the term of office of the house that was dissolved. The five-year period shall run to the same five-year term.
Okay. I think it assists anyway. When Parliament is dissolved, a new election will be called. Papel, a new election will be called. You elect again within 30 days, or 3 months anyway. Then you have Parliament. I think the point is that not when the date expires, and then you give them a grace period. It's a separate issue. When they meet as a house and dissolve themselves with 250+1, surely in between there, we have to have a situation where you regulate it correctly. And then how do you do then? I think we should look at it, and the lawyers are here. Yes, Pastor?
Jay, thanks. Good morning, and morning to honorable members. I just want to make sure, we are talking about the one in 47.1b, where it's dissolved by, at the moment it says two-thirds majority, but we said 50+1. Now, there is a provision there, a proviso that says that in such instances, the National House must be reconstituted in accordance with the provisions of Sections 28 and 29. And that reconstituted house shall function for the unexpired portion. Yeah, thanks, Chair.
But then when you go to 2 A and B, it contradicts what is happening in 1B, because it says any person who, on the date of dissolution of the National House, is a member, remains a member of the House, and the National House remain competent to function. I think there's contradiction there.
Thanks, Chair. I think DG or somebody spoke to that. Remember, this is for urgent business only. And let's say the National House dissolves. The term has ended, or they've dissolved themselves. There's no more National House. Like currently, the term has ended. There's no National House. But Parliament, in terms of the existing law, refers bills to the National House for comments, then that is an urgent business that they need to take care of. And all that this clause is saying, that despite the fact that the House is dissolved, the Minister may call them together for urgent business, so the business doesn't stand still and can be taken care of. It may look like a contradiction, but it's the words that are right on top of that page actually emphasizes that it's only for urgent business. Thanks, Chief.
I think the other point that Honourable Malam has made is a point that I think we need to consider. For example, at the end of the term, there are all these provisions and so on. The provinces take their time to reconstitute. At the moment, as Deputy Minister Opele has indicated, that we'll only be reconstituting in October. And we're supposed to have reconstituted on the 16th of August. Now, provinces take their time. So if it is stated here that, you know, after the National House has dissolved and everything that we're explaining, the interim measures, within a period of this March, provinces should have finalized their processes. You know, I think that sort of point, provinces will not just sit and neglect this point.
Okay.
Uh, Chair, about the time frames. Yeah, no, just on the time frame issue that some members have raised, the cross-reference that we just pointed out earlier to sections 28 and 29 that says this is what will apply, those clauses do have time frames. In other words, when the house is dissolved and you have to reconstitute, then the provisions of 28 and 29, including the provisions that they have about time frames, will automatically also apply. That's 60 days and the 21 days. It depends on, depends on the specific process.
Are we being fair by saying that at least one woman must be a member of the provincial house? Because we have already said fair representation of women in the provincial house. Now, when we move on to say at least one of them, what if they want to have three? Okay.
Okay. If three of them are women, well and good.
Yeah.
Okay. Or two, yeah. Five, but can't be
minimum.
Zero.
Is no check the point? Let's move on.
Chair, I just want to refer to 2C and D. Now, C I have no problem with, but D I do. It says, the election of senior traditional leaders and, where applicable, senior Khoisan leaders. I'm thinking, for example, of the Western Cape, where there are no recognized traditional leaders in the Western Cape. But you will have recognized Khoisan leaders. Now, your "where applicable" here would then be in the wrong place. It should be as per C, because it's basically saying, must make provision for the election of senior traditional leaders, but there aren't any. So do you understand what I'm getting at here? That the where applicable needs to move to the start of the sentence. Where applicable, the election of senior traditional leaders and Khoisan leaders, as provided for in section 28.1.
Are you happy with that? You stand a chance to be a traditional leader. Don't take it far away.
I was before I resigned.
You were a traditional leader?
Before.
Oh, right. That village then must be the most difficult village.
Because I left.
No, because you left, yes.
Because I'm so cheap.
Oh, I was fired. 15 years ago. Free fire 15 years ago. Oh, no, no, okay. No, Professor, that's a good idea. There should be no double parking. You did well, Professor, but that village is still very poor even today. With a professor teaching in university, village is worse.
You got it, man. You go to him,
man. Let's go for the yellow one. Agreed. Clause A. Roman figure 1 and 2. We have worked on this one. We have amended it. We are just again verifying members are happy with amendment. When there are issues that are lacking there, we can still include them. Honorable Mthethwa, you are happy? Can we move to B? B, let's move to 4. Local houses of traditional leaders and KOI, leadership leaders. Clause 50, let's go to 1. Clause 1, 2, 3, 4. Thank you, Honorable Papel. Clause 50, one is
thanks, Chapter. Where we're saying a premier may, by notice in the Relevant Province Gazette, establish a local house and so on. At the moment, we do have, I think it's Eastern Cape. I don't know which other province doesn't have a local house. Free State, yes. So it is because of the May. Now, the question would be, you know, if this structure is as important as it should be. If we leave it as may, you know, we may continue to have, it's about almost 20 or so years that other provinces didn't look at this thing as something obligatory.
It's an option right now. Honourable Melham?
Chair, one of the cornerstones of our constitution is that we have three separate independent and interdependent spheres of government. By leaving it as may, you are leaving it up to the provinces to decide whether or not they want it. And that is again, a cornerstone of democratic principle, that people choose what they want and what they don't want. So if a province decides that they don't want it or that they can't afford it, then that should be their prerogative. Essentially, you're wanting to fit this, hammer this into the legislation with a must, making it obligatory for provinces to establish these local houses, when the provinces themselves may not desire those local houses.
Honourable Mthethwa.
So, Chair, yeah, I think at first we agree that we must align the structures. For alignment purposes, we must put the must, so that even those provinces that they don't have structures is fine, but let those that they have, they need to constitute, they must constitute within the prescribed time. Otherwise, if we leave it like this, we are going to go back to the similar situation that till this time some provinces have not done anything.
But what would be the reason provinces have not doing it, teacher? It's just they are lazy or they don't want to do it?
Chairperson, one of the reasons is financial considerations, that perhaps they have not prioritized it. And because the point, the most important point is, perhaps the question we need to ask ourselves is, you know, where local houses have been established, and, you know, and where local houses have not been established, you know, are these local houses making any impact? So that, as Honourable Mthethwa is saying, so that we don't leave a province to say, no, we can't do this one. It must be done elsewhere and so on. Because these are structures from national house, provincial house, local house, to traditional council. In the same way, the configuration of municipalities. You can't leave a province to say, if it doesn't want to have a district municipalities, it can go ahead without having a district or something, yeah.
Just a question to the department, because it starts becoming quite confusing. The members of the provincial house are elected and selected from where? Are they elected and selected from the traditional councils, or are they elected and selected from the traditional, the local houses? Because if they're selected from the traditional councils, you already have a structure at a local level, namely that traditional council or that Khoisan council, which would imply then that there is absolutely no reason why you should have. And remember that those traditional councils have an area of jurisdiction as well. So there would be an implication that there is no need to have a local house. Further, one of the bones of contention has been the Section 81 of the Municipal Systems Act, which includes traditional leadership in council decisions, municipal council decisions. So they have representation there. So now why do we have another structure outside of that? So you've got a traditional council, you've got a local house, plus you've got traditional leaders sitting on the municipal council. How much more do you actually want to fund? How much more representation do traditional communities and traditional leadership need? Is there a need for local houses? And honestly, I cannot see why you would want to have a local house when you've got traditional councils and Khoisan councils.
Honorable Masondo will follow.
My understanding, Chairperson, is that we have recognized through our constitution traditional leaders as very important in ensuring that overall governance happens. In other words, we see them as an important element to be integrated into the overall governance of the country. If this is not the approach, then one should be corrected. But if it is, in terms of the constitution, then we need to ensure that we pursue what Honorable Mtito was talking about earlier on, ensuring alignment and ensuring that these structures are in place. This whole thing of making it an option that may or may not be implemented and so on may lead to confusion, especially at an early stage.
Lawyers, I think we know to use your word where applicable. Assist us there.
Chair, thank you. When we drafted these clauses, we looked very carefully at what the Constitution is saying. Section 212(2) of the Constitution says, national or provincial legislation may establish provincial and local houses and other houses. It's a may. So the Constitution does not make it compulsory to have houses. And therefore we can't in this bill come and make it a must. That will be contradictory to the Constitution. So it's a discretion to have these houses. On the question, there are experts here that can deal with the question on how the provincial houses are established, but it differs from province to province. It's done in terms of provincial legislation. In some instances, it's dependent on the councils, traditional councils being established. On some, it's dependent on local houses being there. I will leave that one to the experts. But just on, if you read section 212(2), that is why we have said, if you will see the clause everywhere, provincial houses and the one with local houses, and it's a may. It may be established. Thanks, Chair.
Okay. They may remain. It's a constitutional obligation now. Okay. But we have to encourage them to set up these structures wherever they want to set them up. I want to make a point that colleagues take a body break. You have been detained too long. 10 minutes just to do some work and then start moving. Okay. Otherwise, the staff is always detained here. They can't go outside. You can just get rid of it and move on. Doesn't make sense. Yes, it's tight and I'm sorry. But again, we'll have time. Is the study group still meeting?
At four.
Okay, corner. Until 12, honorable staff. One just to ensure that you relax a bit. It's mentally testing all this language issue. It's very exhaustive because one word is interpreted many times. Can you fool? What are you fool? That's the end of it now. Yeah. You want to? Thank you.
Which one is the one? The previous one was the Not our custom. We will see. I'm sure we'll be working very closely with the consumer. I'm running the business line. Even though there are times when I spend a lot of time crowded, because I spend a lot of time there are particular times. But I'm heavy now because after this level, I have just been called there to the discount. I'll be spending a lot of time here and until I'm coming up on the I don't know where to
colleagues, the meeting is called to order. The meeting is called to order. Honorable Masipe, you are right. Can we resume our work? We are not far away. We're not far away. Can we move then to section 50, Honorable Malham?
We're busy with section 50.
Yeah.
So what Dr. Bester said just before we broke was that section 212 says that national legislation may provide for the establishment of houses of traditional leaders. And he's correct, it does say that. But nowhere does it say it must provide for local houses of traditional leaders. It says it may provide for houses of traditional leaders. Now, we've provided for a national house, and we've provided for provincial houses. My question, and this goes directly to the department, to the DG, is do we have a need for local houses? Why do we have a need for it? Given that we have traditional councils, we have traditional leaders serving on municipal councils, why do we now need another structure that we're not mandated to provide, and B, I cannot see a function for it outside of what is already established.
Okay. Colleagues, that's a point that is raised. DG, any point?
Thanks very much. No, I get the point. I want to put it in two ways. The first one is that currently, you know, the local houses are not funded. And as a result, they are not functional. And, you know, if one looks at that consideration and making an argument for the local houses to be established, then it defeats the purpose if they are not funded. If there is no funding, that's number one. Which means, you know, I agree with you on the first point. But the second point is we have almost 80% of the provinces that have traditional leaders, that have established local houses. And the earlier question you asked was that the elections, are people elected from traditional councils and so on? I think I have the officials here. They would know the exact, because it seems to me that in other provinces, members are elected from the local houses and so on, if they could give that detail. But there is this first consideration, which means that, you know, we have the law and we don't have resources that are allocated to that structure. Then you render it, you know, ineffective and, you know, that's the point that I would like to
follow up. Yes. DG, thank you for that. But you didn't answer my question. What are these local houses going to do that is different from the traditional councils or the Khoisan councils? In other words, what function are they going to perform that is different from the structures that we are funding?
Attempt to respond to it. You know, the officials will also come in. For example, the configuration of these structures, as I indicated earlier, a local house is equivalent to a district, which means that under that one local house, you would have various traditional councils at the lowest level. The intention was a good intention, to say if you strengthen the local house, then you would have stronger traditional councils. And so, you know.
With all due respect, there's an argument for the dissolution of district municipalities as well, because they serve no real functional purpose. So to say that a local house is analogous to a district is somewhat, well, I don't know. I don't know if it helps your argument. Again, What exactly will they do? What will these what is the function of these local houses that is different from a traditional council? What can they do that a traditional council can't do?
Well, I will could be so.
Press
something.
Yeah. I just want to give a general answer from a practical experience. For instance, the Tweek Otumulo district, now known as King Tejoya district, basing it on your analysis, DG, where there is a house at a district level. Now, within Otumulo district, there are six municipalities, local municipalities. Each municipality would have traditional leaders that meet, that come together, discuss the issues at a local level, but it spills over to the district because there may be issues of common interest affecting traditional leaders within the local municipality level, and then they move over to the district level. What is it that Honorable Mayhem is asking? What is it that they do? That is the question. Well, they talk about issues of development of their tribal traditional authorities, issues of conflicts, you know, sharing views on the cases and everything that has to do with traditional leadership. That is my understanding. Then it grows from there, and then there are elections that are held. Then they form a local house at a district level. That has been my understanding. Mhlawumbe nje kuthiwa nje sihlalo khona le mhlangano ebeke ihlangano yamakhosi endaweni ethiwa imhlangano okanye yangantathu, where they meet after 3 months, they discuss common issues. Inkosi from that area and that area, they come together within that municipality, then they meet, they discuss issues of common interest. Then at a certain point in time, then they meet at that level of a district. I don't think I am giving a true answer or sufficient answer for Honorable Mayhem, but this is the example that I know, and that some of us within our localities have been attending these meetings, whereby you go there, you are part of the delegation, you also voice your desires there. So thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable Matthew.
Chair, you know, the department itself must not be seen to be pushing the interest of traditional leaders. That is my feeling, one. Because I know for a reason. The professor might be speaking for KZN, but I am also talking for Limpopo. that I know this regional, this district houses we are talking about, are not meeting. The only time they meet is when the end of the term of the houses come to an end. That's the only time when they meet, because they come together, then they lobby, they do all sorts of things. But there are no concrete programs at that level. There are no discussions. Also, given the animosity and mutual mistrust that is actually happening among traditional leaders. You remember Skukune, for instance. Skukune is highly divided. That house, it can't sit. The only time it sits is when there are elections for the houses. So, as a committee chair, I think some of these things we must not just, you know, allow them to go through, because we know for certain that when we stay in those areas, we know that these houses are not united. They are fighting amongst themselves. So we must not, you know, multiply these houses. There is no point that we should be having district houses, like you said, Professor. The only house that we can actually bend and say, okay, this one, that is the district, I mean the provincial house. Because in any case, when they have met us also, they overlook district and go straight to the provincial house. They don't go to those houses because they are fighting amongst themselves. So we must not, you know, be seen to be multiplying these houses, also based on financial considerations that have been mentioned here. Thank you.
Local houses are existing as we are talking. They are operational. They do the work that they do. May not be satisfactory the way we see it, but it is working there. They're already operating, and in Eastern Cape there were delays, but there's no principal objection to have local houses. I think the point that was raised earlier on, that where applicable you can allow this to happen. There'll be areas really that today may not even exist, and then it can't be a bigger problem for us on that. I want us to move on this issue. Let me take Professor Kubis and then we'll follow.
Thank you, Chairperson. I believe that Honorable Matsebe speaking is giving us a sort of a different scenario, which I would say let the department look into. And of course, he concurs that that might be happening in KwaZulu-Natal. I have not visited other provinces to start with, but in KwaZulu-Natal, definitely these houses meet. And you'll find that at a certain time, the MEC for COCTA would go there and open them officially, and then they will begin to be in session, to begin their work, and then they will go back to their communities. For instance, Umntwana Wapindangene, for instance, Ezululand, has been for a long time elected as a chair of the local house of traditional leaders. I'm just citing one example. Mhlambe Umntwana Inkosi Yakwabiyela, who was a member of parliament here, was the chairperson of the one in King Bedwayo. So my knowledge is that they do meet and they do work from time to time. But it's a different situation that he's bringing in, and which I would recommend that the department looks into it. For we can't just ignore it. If they just come there when it's election and they don't meet in those areas, but I have a different scenario, I'm sharing a different scenario where I've seen them meeting from time to time to deal with their issues.
Melham, and then Professor will come in, and then teach you, close.
Chair, I still haven't heard anyone tell me what these local houses actually do. You said they are there, they are working in terms of the existing legislation. I just want to remind everyone, and the state law advisor used the term at our last meeting. She said that the principal act, this act is not an amendment. This act repeals the Traditional Leadership Governance Framework Act. So there is no principal act. This is the principal act. So what we decide here becomes the law. And the fact that there are local houses in existence, and again, nobody has been able so far to tell me what they do, no one has given me one shred of evidence that these are, you said that they are working, but I want to know what they are doing, and what they are doing that is different from what the traditional councils are doing. No one's told me that. So we could take a decision here today that says, yes, we have a national house, yes, we have a provincial house, no, we don't have local houses. Now, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that. What I am saying is that you are, in terms of this, in terms of what Honorable Mteto was saying, is that he was saying that they must be established, and I'm saying, no, this is something that should the provinces want it, they should have the right to have that choice. Now, I think that is not something that we can take away that decision from the provinces, particularly seeing as we are imposing a financial burden on the provinces to establish them. We are saying, you must fund them. You must provide them with administrative support. And you yourself said, Chair, that in many instances, in fact, the DG said, in many instances, provinces don't have the resources to do that. Now, if they don't have the resources, for us to go around and say, you must do it, it means you've got to take money from somewhere else to put it, take it from education, take it from housing, take it from water and sanitation, to create the establishment of these local houses, because we have now said as law that they must do it. And that's not right.
Malala. And Professor will follow.
Thank you, Chairperson. For the question that was asked as to, in terms of the bill, restricting the answer to that, what is the distinction of the functions of the local houses as well as the traditional councils? It appears, Chairperson, on clause 50 sub 6 in relation to the local houses, but in respect of the traditional council, it's what clause 26 to set out. Thank you, Chair.
Professor?
The point that...
Oh, let us start with Professor Latsa.
Okay. Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, yes, I think maybe we need also to understand the history of where does local houses originate from. I think we need to just go back a little bit and see. Originally, there were institutions like what we called regional authorities in the past. And if you go back and study what the regional authorities achieved at the time, you will be very surprised. And I want to link up with Prof on that side to say we need to understand it in terms of culture. Within a local municipality or a district municipality, there's no room for individual traditional councils to forward common interests. So the role of a local house is really to work together to achieve common interests within the local municipality. That is why you must understand the amendments of this act in relation, the establishment of the local houses in relation to the amendments to Section 81. Currently, in terms of the law, 20% of a municipal council must be traditional leaders at a local and a district municipality. This act changes that totally. It says that if the house is established at a local level, it will be the chairperson and two people who will participate. At the district level, it will be the chairpersons of the local houses plus one member from each local municipality. If you look at the figures, it comes down dramatically in terms of financial responsibilities. But the point is, when it's about development of that specific district municipality or local municipality, I think the role that local houses play to coordinate and to get to a common understanding of things, we must not miss it. And as she has said, the tasks and the functions of local houses are very clear in the legislation. And I don't think we can sit here and say local houses are not functioning. There might be some of them that are not functioning as good as others. But in many instances, local houses are really doing a good job. So, especially in case that, and I think you can go back and look at the minutes of the meetings of these houses. Our information is in that in case that, and it does work very well.
even in Northern Cape, the local house in the Northern Cape is functioning really well, and it contributes. If you talk to municipalities, you will hear that a municipality doesn't have the time, if they want to do something in a local municipal area, to go to each and every traditional council to get their view. So the role of coordination in terms of development initiatives and what will happen, that role is being played by this local house. And we must also understand they only meet once a quarter. And as I said, you must see it in relation with Section 81. The numbers and the figures goes down quite a bit on the Section 81. So it sort of balances the financial implications of this. Thank you.
Let me check, Professor. Did you recover? Okay, let us move now.
Good evening,
Vice
Chair. Professor, I beg to differ with you, sir, because if you say we must dig into the past to see what these structures were intended for, they were intended for different purposes, and those were political. They were not, you know, democratic institutions. So I beg to differ with you on that basis. That let's not, like, you know, the feedback we got from the consultations throughout the whole provinces was that the whole act is based on apartheid, what you call boundaries and what have you. Now you're going back and say let's dig into the past, but that is not that was not, you know, in the intention there was quite different from what we are sitting here today. Today we are saying we are transforming these structures. We are transforming them, we are not multiplying them. So on that note, I really differ with you, because the people outside there, they are saying no, we don't, this thing is based on former apartheid structures. Thank you.
Okay. Can we pass on our members? We'll put a question there, we may come back to it. It's very helpful to sleep over a matter, just again to reflect on it. We are trusting a national legislation already in many areas. They are existing, they are doing that developmental role, the appeal of communication and consultation with communities. They make proposals to local authorities. Generally, they are doing some role. Other areas, of course, are not because of a particular situation. Then, because we are drafting a national legislation, let us sleep over this matter. We'll come back to it. Let us move on to two. Local house must consist of not less than 5 members. 3, all senior traditional leaders. Section 50, clause 3, any issue there? Clause 4, any issue there? 4A is only one traditional council, only one coalition council, all those issues there. Any point that we need further elaboration, discussion, can we move to clause 4B? Are in total more than one, but not more than 5 traditional councils. All senior traditional leaders there. All chairpersons, all branch heads. Can we move on? Page 115. AA, provided that where there is more than one. Can we move? That is a clause AA of Section 50, clause B, clause 4B. AA there, BB, traditional sub-council. Can we move to clause C? C, Roman figure 1, 2, 3. It's just a composition. CAA, page 115. CPP, traditional sub-council of the same traditional community. Clause 5, page 116. Five A, senior traditional leader. B, traditional council. Clause 6, the function of local house are. Yeah. Then I'm talking about the local houses now. Let us look at them. Roman figure 1, 2, 3.
There is some that is the traditional council.
Hmm. Let's move on if there's no issue. Clause 7, local house must meet at least 4 times a year. Clause 8, 117. The term of a local house is 5 years. The red one, deleted. Yellow one, inserted. Clause 9, the traditional and quiescent leaders participate in the proceedings. Clause 10, 117 there. A province must provide administrative and financial support. Yes, sir.
Chair, the second half of Clause 10 says a province must provide administrative and financial support to local houses, but the second half says, provided that where local houses are established for the areas of jurisdiction, well, all local houses are established for an area of jurisdiction of a local municipality, so that part is moot anyway. The administrative support to such houses may be provided as a shared service on district or metropolitan level. Essentially what you're saying is that this legislation is now going to impose additional burdens on local municipalities, metro municipalities and district municipalities. And it doesn't mention local in there at all, even though the houses are established at a local municipality level. So my question is, given that municipalities, and Chair, you would know this as well as any of us around this table, that municipalities are in a financial crunch, where are they going to find the funds to share this financial responsibility?
Honourable Pastor.
Chair, thanks. No, if we read the clause, it's not the municipal councils that's providing the support. It's the province. It's the provincial department responsible for traditional leadership matters. And all that this one is basically saying is there's no need to go and provide the support or make it, you know, for every single local house that is there, where you can make it available as a shared service.
Yeah, DG?
Yes, I also wanted to indicate that shared service could, among others, include office space. We have examples of such, where a district or the municipality is,
Can we move to page 118, the small one is page 43, those average. Can we move then G, H, I, J, K, L? Any point there that we think is should not be there? Clause 11, A, B, C, D until L. Let's move to clause 12. A premier may take regulations. Can we move to clause 13? The members of a local house must, before they begin to perform their functions in a local house, take an oath or solemn affirmations. Before a judge of the High Court designated by the judge president. Judge president is in provinces, huh? Okay. Honorable Melham?
Chair, I'm concerned about 11 and 12. I'm concerned because, on the one hand, the minister may make regulations, and on the other hand, the premier may make regulations. that may not be inconsistent. First of all, I don't understand why the Premier would be making regulations and not the MEC for cooperative governance and traditional affairs. Why would it be the Premier that has to make those regulations? But secondly, we are going to end up, we're going to end up with disparate regulations. You're going to have regulations that apply in KZN that are different to the regulations that apply in the Eastern Cape. Because we're now allowing... Now, that can be a good thing. But if that's the case, then we need to take away the I guess we're kind of ending up with a duplication of function here between the minister and the province, with both of them having the ability to make regulations. And let's say the province makes a set of regulations and the minister then comes out and makes new regulations that they don't align to. It does create problems down the line.
No, I understand, Chairperson. I think what is important with the law, it must have uniformity. What obtains with the local house, let me say so, in Northwest must also obtain with the local house in Free State. So there is a need for uniformity. And I agree that the law should come from one center, from the minister, and that law would apply at the provincial level downwards up to the local level. I think Honorable Mayhem is coming from that angle.
I think these regulations, I understand the argument, but the regulations, I think, in the same way we have a national legislation and the province is coming up with their legislation, which does not, the point on regulations, the point is that the regulation,
we have the framework at the national level. Each province must come with its legislation which is consistent with the national legislation. So I thought it is along those lines. But the reason why it is not the MEC of COXA, in order to be consistent, if you look at the person who appoints various levels of percentage, I would go a king and queen, the premier. But the Premier has delegated that function to an MEC.
Thanks, Jay. Besides, of course, the attempt to bring in national norms and standards, the fact is that in some of the provinces, they want to establish local houses, but they do not have not yet made provision for that in their own laws. Or where there is provision, the relevant provincial legislation may not be totally sufficient. So when drafting the bill, we thought, let's bring in norms and standards firstly, but also bring in this provision so that this particular clause 50 can actually be used without the need for a province to go and amend their laws or to have to prepare new provisions in their laws. The idea of having the Premier, of course, also, the Premier or the MEC, we can just talk about that one, but to have the province also make regulations is just for that provincial peculiarities, because it does differ a little bit from province to province. So you'll have, if there's regulations in terms of Subsection 11, national regulations, there can be in terms of the Subsection 12 also, but they obviously can't be in contradictory to the 11 regulations.
Okay.
Sorry, there is just a little bit of, something that they are whispering to me, which, you know, needs to be clarified on the issue of regulations. Yes.
I was just clarifying with the DG regarding the sub-clause 12, the regulations to be made by the Premier, as opposed to those which will be made under sub-clause 11. Sub-clause 11, the minister is empowered to make regulations pertaining to all those matters which are listed there. And now we have sub-clause 12, which also provides for the same matters, regulations on the same issues. But now the only qualification is that those regulations must not be inconsistent with those which are made by the minister. And the clarity that I was seeking from the DG, is sub-clause 12 really necessary? Because we need to avoid creating vagueness in legislation. And also for uniformity, there will be now two sets of regulations, those which will be made by the minister and those which will be made by the premier on the same issue. So I was just, you know, whispering to the DG whether would sub-clause 12 be really necessary when we have sub-clause 11 on the same issues, regulating the same issues?
Allow them also to have regulation at the provincial level as long as I'm nice with the national one. Some provinces may want to do so. May not be harmful to leave the clause quiet. In case other provinces, the ones who elaborate further, they may do that, but that doesn't cause harm anyway. It's a harmless clause. The professor is a very harmless clause. It's actually more facetious, but it's a harmless clause. Allow people to take some position based on their own. Whatever they do is just for hope you are deserving national, because they can't do anything that is inconsistent with the national regulation. And then some important harms.
This section, if it refers to further commissions beyond the current one, Kapa Commission started a process, and this current one is completing the outstanding disputes that were left, which were 1,244 matters. Beyond this, I'm just thinking that, you know, we were going to institutionalize this function within the department to be able to deal with this rather than having a commission forever and so on. But Dr. Bester can clarify that, and Mr. Stone.
Chair, the Khoisan Sun will come. It's the advisory committee on Khoisan matters that follows after this particular part of the chapter. Look, this is I remember members asked about this commission previously in one of the meetings. Just to confirm, the very first wording there, there in section 52.18, says subject, 51.1, subject to section 70 10. That's the transitional provision. Just want to confirm, this commission here is the current Commission of Traditional Leadership Disputes and Claims. The reason why it's in this bill, you will see that the provisions are very, very, very similar. It's basically copy and paste from the Framework Act. It's because it still exists. But it's subject to Section 7010. And if you read 7010, we talk there about a new commission and an old commission. New commission just meaning the one in the TKLB, old commission meaning the one in the Framework Act. Now, all it says is this one in TKLB, which is exactly the same commission, shall only exist for the until the expiry of the term of the existing one. So it's not a brand new commission. It's just confirming the current one. What is interesting, however, is that we brought in, and we discussed this also at one of the meetings, if you allow me just to jump quickly to that clause, the clause about functions of the commission, 56, you will find it on page 125 of the bill. When we get there, Chair, subclause 8, that was brought in after discussions with stakeholders and including this committee, a procedure as to what can provinces do with claims that do not fall within the jurisdiction of the particular CTLDC, the current existing one, but we will get there. But all these other clauses are basically exact duplication of what is in the Framework Act.
You know, after that explanation, the current commission's term is expiring end of December this year, and there's no prospect of wanting to extend it further. They are left with less than 100 disputes and claims that they are, that they are processing. So, yeah. The purpose of the commission to start with was to rectify the wrongs of the past. That's why in CLAPO was to determine how many paramounties are there, and then they found that there are so many. And then they came back to say, who are the incumbents? And after finalizing, so people were asked to put in their claims if they've been wrongfully, all that. Now, what will be remaining after end of December will be the usual disputes with royal family that are there, and so forth. So, which the department, in my view, perhaps can take care of, and so on, rather than keeping a commission perpetually outside the 1,244 backlog that in Kapo could not finish.
Question on what the DG has just said. The Inhlapo Commission has got a term of office. It's a fixed term. What happens if they don't finish those 1,244 issues by the end of that term? What happens to the unresolved issues?
Chairperson, thank you. When this current commission started in 2011, that's the figure it inherited from the previous Nkapo Commission. It inherited 1,244 cases. So currently, it is actually left with less than 50 cases to finalize. So we are 100% sure that by the end of December, all claims and disputes that were inherited and that were before the commission when it took over shall have been finalized. So that's basically what the DG is saying. Now, any other new matter that will come, there's a different process that they will have to follow.
It won't be the bigger issues.
No.
It will be about whether they function, they've got a problem here and there, then it
There is convention. There are many people masquerading as kings. You know, if they know there's a commission, they just send in new things. And we're saying that people were given the opportunity to say this is the opportunity for everybody to submit. And then it was the period expired in February 2010 or something. They extended it to the end of August 2010 for those that might have been left out.
I just wanted to find that I do hear that there would be no function for the commission after the end of the year. I just want to find out, will there be a particular proclamation to say this is closed or what? Or it will just be known that the term has ended?
Chairperson, when the commission was appointed and when its term was extended, there was a proclamation that was saying it is extended from this time to this time. So there won't be any proclamation to say there is no more commission. So it is by end of December, in terms of that proclamation which established it, it ceases to exist. Then the president may use the relevant act to appoint a commission.
Chair, if the commission is, and its term of office expires in December this year, can I just get clarity on something here through you, Chair? What is the likelihood of this bill being passed by December? Given that it's a bill that affects traditional leaders, it would have to go to the National House of Traditional Leaders for consultation. It has to be passed by the NCOP, which will have to do their own public hearings on it, which is at least 6 weeks we're talking about. It's unlikely that this piece of legislation is going to be passed by December. It's very unlikely. Even if we pass it next week in the NA, it's unlikely that it will be passed by December and signed. What's the point of having a whole section on the Nhlapo Commission or on the Commission for Traditional Leadership? I mean, it becomes an irrelevant section because it's dead.
Remember, let me just quickly say, when the bill was tabled in 2015, this was still very relevant, this particular clause. But I want the committee to please look at page 125 and 126, subclause 8. Subclause 8, I think, if the committee agrees, we must find a way of keeping it while deleting all these other clauses. It's on top of page 125. Because this makes provision for how do you deal with claims that fall outside of this commission that's disappearing.
I have no problem with that whatsoever. I do think that on 120, well, clause 57, needs to be incorporated as well, because even if we don't put in anything about the establishment of the commission, there are still the recommendations of the commission that need to be recognized as legitimate findings, and a process needs to be in place. So I think that Clause 57 in some way needs to be retained during the transitional period.
Because these matters may always be held.
Clause 57 on recommendations. After deleting the bigger chunk earlier, there will have to be context, you know, paragraph or something.
Just for context, okay, so the commission makes its findings and they get accepted and whatever implemented, but in 15 years' time there's some kind of a dispute somewhere. How is that dealt with? Sure, Chair, but there may be disputes. Now, I just think that maybe we need to codify that a dispute will be dealt with in a particular way. Which clause?
It's partly covered by this one that we asked to keep on page 125. The sub-clause 8 is partly dealing with that. But also, Chair, some of the provinces, for example, Northwest, they have detailed provisions in their own provincial legislation on how to deal with claims in disputes.
All right, fair enough.
I also wanted to indicate that, for example, there may be a new case of kingship or queenship that may arise. There are mechanisms in place to say, you know, a claim must start through the provincial house, through the premier, and so there are those sort of mechanisms as well.
Not
Committees, in fact, were not extended. The term of committees, other than the Limpopo one, were not extended when they expired. Yeah. So it must be deleted.
And then until passing, then it gives a very important one. So it's that one can't be deleted, but it's not even started.
The issue, I don't know how we cater for the, I think even in your public hearings, even in our own consultative processes as a department, there's been this thing of saying, why do you juniorize the committee? You've had a commission to deal with, traditional leadership in the African communities, and here you're establishing a committee. And, I just wanted to, because there are people who feel very strongly that why do you call this one a committee? Not a committee, even if it doesn't matter, but the language we use, needs.
I thought the DG was going to give us the terminology that they suggested. The DG is saying using the word committee was a matter of, they felt it was a matter of making it junior. What was the suggestion then?
Hey Jay, in the beginning, when this was discussed about the name of this body, we wanted to firstly avoid confusion, because remember, there is a commission in the bill, which you have now taken out, but that was the one reason, not having a bill talking about two commissions. Now the commission that was in the bill, or is currently still in the bill, has been a commission from the beginning under that name, Klapu Commission, followed by CTLDC, etc. We've always said to the Khoisan colleagues who raised this, it's the name of the structure becomes irrelevant. It's all about the functions. So whatever you call it, you need to go and look at the functions. But usually a commission has decision-making power, which, remember, the original Klapu Commission had decision-making power. That was changed later on in 2011 when it became recommendations. But now, for the committee to consider, now that we are removing the CTLDC out of the bill, we can change the name. It's not going to make a difference to the functions. But if it will...
Function
that is coming, yes. Secretary, is that coming in? David, is
yes, coming
it's coming
in.
Yes,
sir.
Okay, let us wait for it then. There's no harm to wait for another minute. It's coming here, 30 minutes ago. Let us take the coin, sir. It's very nice to deal with it when you are hungry. We won't have but we have discussed this with you. We agree that we put commission on coins then my friend. And then we look at the function. Can we move on? Page 180, clause 69. Sub 1. Any issue? Appointment of members. Clause 2, sub 1. Qualification for a person. Member of advisory committee. They don't take decisions, they make recommendations. Move to the name. Let's go to E. May appoint a special offender, which is coming in there. F, the minister name, any issue there, subclause F. G, subclause 2, a member of the Brazilian community, a full time or part time member, determined by the minister. Commissioner appointed by president. Can a minister appoint a commission? The honorable minister?
Okay. Chair, I don't know the answer to your question. I
thought all commissions are appointed by president. But the minister can appoint a commission.
Okay. Chair, my point is relating to clause D. Subclause D of 61. I have no problem with the clause itself. I just think that from a drafting perspective, it should come at the end of the clause. In other words, it should come after G. Just because everything else talks about the appointment process, and then the last thing that should be happened is that it must be published in the Gazette. So I would move D down to G. And obviously that's going to affect your 61A, where you refer to subject to paragraphs.
Okay. I think that's fine. Can we move 1 to 2? Thank you.
Just on that one, Chair, we will, because there's a cross-reference to Clause 54, which is one that we're deleting. So we will just bring that in, copy and paste it into this one.
Format will that duly authorized take? In other words, how do I know that XYZ person is duly authorized?
So does it mean that there would have been a meeting with resolutions to officially nominate that particular member? Because I'm asking the same question like Honorable Mayhem.
I may be wrong, Chair, but I think my understanding is that the advisory committee or the commission now will have to determine the format in which applications must be applied, and they have to issue a notice on this. And in this notice, everything must be addressed that needs to be done and how it has to be done. And I would assume that this will include the duly authorised, whether it's by decision of the community, meeting of the community that's captured. The whole purpose is that this advisory committee must prepare or be fully prepared, you know, for how they want applications to be received and what are the requirements for these applications. And if you look at the process, it's going to be an easy process in the sense of it's something that you can continuously add on or clarify as and when the process starts.
Thank you.
Just with regard to 2 sub A, where it says that the advisory committee may only investigate in terms of within a period of 2 years from a date to be determined by the minister, or any such further period as the minister may determine by notice in the Gazette. I just think that leaves it very open-ended. It basically says, well, you know what, here's 2 years. If you don't finish in 2 years, I'll give you another 10 years, I'll give you another 20 years, and we end up with some of the issues that we've had with the TLGFA, where this thing is open-ended. Now, I would much rather that we put a fixed period in the legislation.
5 years.
I don't care what it is. I mean, if we say by the 31st of March 2022, that all applications must be dealt with and processed or whatever it might be, okay, that we put it in the legislation, and if need be, that we then amend the legislation, because it then makes the minister that much more accountable for ensuring that this happens.
The Nkapo Commission was 5 years. It was anticipated that within 5 years they would have finalized. They only dealt with 18 kingship matters. That's it. And then the rest is what is being done. So we don't know whether 5 years, because this is the first time we do this. But I agree with the principle that
we extend it. If they don't finish their work, we extend.
We extend it, okay.
And then don't make 5 years a cut and dry. Just
okay.
5 years they give report. And sometimes some of the report won't be financial. They can be giving report as they are published. But 5 years then they finalize the achievement of this report based on that. They can then extend by whatever time that they require. But it's important to give them a time. It's not going to be easy. It's going to be the most complex one. And then the public hearing was very clear that too many don't qualify completely, but they claim that they are leaders who will be in the surely the appointed council itself will look at some of the issues that in themselves will apply, and then the commission will work it out.
Thanks, Jay. I wanted to explain quickly this particular clause, 65. This time frame that's talked about here is about the lodging of applications. It's not about the term of this advisory committee or commission. And what it basically means is, well, first of all, if you read the whole chapter, the advisory committee or the commission now will have to be established first. But we all know they're not going to, you know, open today their doors and start working, because they need to do preparatory work. So what this clause is saying is that once they are ready, you're going to issue a notice in the Gazette and say, okay, Khoyan San, from now on, or this particular date, you can apply. And they have a two-year period to apply. Once the two-year period is over and done, this commission can only deal with those applications lodged within that two-year period. So if it's, it can be very similar, work out very similar to the Sitori Commission that dealt with a specific number of claims, and once it's done, it's over and done. After that, you go back to the earlier provisions of the bill, around clause 5 and 10, where the provinces will be dealing with applications lots after that. Just to explain that. So I think, for me, the term of 3 years that's already there in the bill, with the possibility to extend, is sufficient. But it means it's limited to those applications lots within the two-year period from the date of notice, not anything that comes after that.
On 138.2c, publish any draft regulations in the Gazette for public comment. It's not a requirement, but it's something that we might want to consider, is bringing those regulations before this portfolio committee for consideration.
Absolutely. There's no harm, really, to bring regulations before. We've been asking that for the DG, that there's no harm for department bringing regulations there. Well, regulation and nothing else is that the implementation mechanism for the fee.
Because the ministers get that name.
Better. there's actually a provision in the Interpretation Act.
Yeah.
I'm not sure which clause exactly in the Interpretation Act, but it says that any notices that are published are supposed to be tabled in Parliament. So if you table, you know, if you publish a notice with regulations, you are actually supposed to table it in Parliament as well.
You make the law very thin and then you just make recommendations so thick, because you run away from questioning here, and then you put recommendation there. Members won't have even the skill of dealing with these ones. And then they used to do that long time ago, but now I think they're very capable department. They come before committees. We have never received one, though, teaching regulation. I know that COCTA, we don't make many regulations. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Chairperson. Again, now that we have the Constitution, we have Section 101.4, which also provides for similar thing that has just been explained. But I think what is crucial for us to know is the extent of the involvement that Parliament would want to have in relation to those regulations, whether it's just for information purposes and giving them awareness that there are such regulations and they just make input, or they would need to be approved, because Section 101.4 of the Constitution says then legislation must indicate the extent in terms of those lines.
Well, sometimes for information purposes, really. I wouldn't think that members of parliament, they want to draw regulations. But must be what is the intention of regulation is to implement the law. Surely if members of parliament have applied their mind in the law, it would be easy to see, but this regulation really is almost a law now. Because we can also circumvent the processes of lawmaking and put it more on regulations. And I think just touching base and say these are issues for information, looking at it, I think, Pumele, that would be helpful. It would be just so much tedious for members of parliament to start drafting regulations. And they've drafted the law. They shouldn't do that, I guess, in regulation. But there will be a situation, I think, would differ from time to time. And sometimes people want to get involved and approve. But I don't think members of parliament should really preoccupy themselves by drafting regulation, because that's the mechanism of implementation of the law. They've drafted the law, then we shouldn't do that. Can we stop now? At clause 68, delegation of powers and duties by the Premier, something to eat, honorable members, you may take something now. Let us break. I'm not sure what is the time. It's almost 2. Can we be 2:15? We start. We start. 2:15 at least we start. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned for lunch.